All right, just so you know what's going on, Chandler and I are kind of going to try and give you more of a holistic view of what's going on at these wetlands, so we're going to be passing the mic back and forth just to liven things up a little bit. But, all right. Amphibians are declining around the world, as many of you have heard. One source indicated that since 1989, over 129 species have either gone extinct or become critically threatened. And there's many hypotheses as to why these populations are declining. One of them is that anthropogenically we've affected the climate. Now that global warming has officially been considered a real thing, we can look at how the climbing temperatures around the globe. It's been suggested that that's going to affect the distribution of certain species. So this may allow some species or some individuals infected with certain pathogens to go into new habitats now and infect naive populations. So that may be one reason. Also, with a thinning ozone layer, it's thought that UVB rays are increasing on the surface of the Earth. And it's been studied that UVB rays increased exposure to UVB rays can cause mortality in egg masses of amphibians and also cause slowing growth or deformities in developing amphibians. Invasive species are also thought to be contributing to amphibian declines. One of the more well-known instances of this are the bullfrogs, which have been introduced into the western United States. And they are thought to be potentially outcompeting certain native species there, and they may even be predating upon certain native species there. And with invasive species, you also get, again, more pathogens transmitted to potentially naive populations. Water contaminants are also thought to be contributing to declining amphibian populations. Pollution in the water may directly kill the amphibians, or it may cause such poor habitat that it's going to decrease the immunocompetence of certain individuals that are in the water and make them more susceptible to pathogens. So all these pathogens I keep talking about, some of the more well-studied ones, this one is Aeromonas hydrophilia, which is a bacteria. It's commonly found in water and actually on the skin of amphibians. However, when individuals are immunocompromised, it's thought to opportunistically attack the individual and cause systemic hemorrhaging. And you can see here, you've got the edema as well as hemorrhaging going on in the groin and leg region. And then you get what's called red leg syndrome. That's the common name for this disease. Chytridiomycosis, this is actually one you may have heard about in the news frequently. This is a fungal disease that's just been recently, it's been researched a lot more recently. And what happens is it disrupts the osmoregulation in the amphibian skin. It attacks keratinized tissue and prevents them from being able to osmoregulate very well. And one of the symptoms is actually the sloughing off of the skin here. You're going to hear a lot more about that when Roberto comes and talks to you from Southern Illinois University. So you'll hear a lot more about that later. Arrhidioviruses are also known to have caused mass mortalities in certain amphibian populations across the globe. The species that attack amphibians are called ranoviruses, and the species that attack frogs are more specifically called frog virus. Frog virus 3, which you'll hear about later, is one of the more well-studied species of this. And Ribeiroria. This is actually a parasitic trematode, and it affects developing individuals, and if it insists at the right location, it can cause malformations once the individual develops into a metamorph and adult. And these malformations are thought to inhibit the animal from moving and therefore cause increased rates of predation upon malformed individuals. More contributors to amphibian declines due to anthropogenic stressors, the most widespread one would be habitat destruction. Expanding cities, various forestry practices, agricultural practices, as well as the use and development of road systems all contribute to amphibian declines. One of the lesser studied and anthropogenic influences on amphibians, however, is cattle grazing. There's been a handful of studies in the last 10 years looking at cattle grazing on amphibians. And I'm going to present them all. Actually, there's only five that we have been able to find. Two of them have been done in Australia by Jansen and Healy, and they correlated amphibian abundance with wetland characteristics. And in the end, they could just suggest that cattle indirectly negatively affect amphibians. That was the result that they could come up with. Two more studies done by Bull and Hayes in Oregon compared the abundance of specifically the Columbia spotted tree frog in grazed and ungrazed areas. And they found that there were no differences in abundance between treatments. However, their grazing intensities and durations were extremely varied, so it wasn't a specific study in that respect. Knutson et al. In 2004 did a study in Minnesota looking at agricultural wetlands as their value for amphibian habitat. And they found that species richness, as well as the abundance of certain species, was lower at certain grazed wetlands. So what on earth are these cattle doing to amphibians? Well, they're grazing the vegetation. Cattle are known to negatively impact the vegetative structure and biomass of shoreline vegetation. And this vegetation is important for amphibians. They use it for cover from predators, for sites for breeding, foraging areas, as well as sites to deposit their eggs. When you lose this vegetation around the wetlands, you're also losing the detritus within the wetlands. The detritus in water actually acts as cover for your tadpoles, as well as for food. Cattle movement in and around the wetlands may directly affect the survival of egg masses. They can directly trample the egg masses themselves, which is going to affect your demographics at later life stages. Further upland, cattle movement around wetland areas and pastures is going to compact the soil. Soil compaction, as well as your loss of vegetation, is going to increase erosion into the wetlands and possibly increase your input of contaminants, pesticides, fertilizers, everything else on the ground is going to come into the water more easily and lower your water quality. And cattle defecation and urination in the water itself is also going to lower the water quality. Chandler? Well, all the species that need to burrow into the ground, the cattle can actually trample on those areas where they would be burrowing. So you might actually smush the frog itself, or you might be just reducing the places where they can actually hide or overwinter, which is something that Betsy actually talked about, having areas to hide in.
Okay, so we got an idea about water quality, a little bit of how they can degrade it. Obviously, that's through defecation, urination, and defecation of feces being entered into the water, be it from runoff or actually directly being in the water itself. This causes an increase in nutrients. You have an increase in ammonia, nitrite, nitrate, and phosphate, which ultimately leads to a process known as eutrophication. And this was slightly covered earlier in your lecture series, but basically, eutrophication is a change in the algal community, and it can cause a decrease in dissolved oxygen, which ultimately can lead to the decrease in growth and survivorship of amphibian larvae and adult amphibians and post-metamorphic amphibians. So if eutrophication, as I was saying, if you have a change in the algal community to more filamentous algae, which can ultimately change the invertebrate composition within the wetland. And you're moving really from foragers to grazers, such as snails. And the reason I have a planorbid snail up here is because we're going to go into the introduction of the tree nematode that Liz was talking about. Planorbid snails act as a host for this parasitic tree nematode. and it has an interesting multi-host life cycle. So beginning with the first host, the bird host, the adult Ribeirurae is inside the bird host, and what the adult Ribeirurae does is lays eggs inside the bird. The bird then excretes the eggs and the feces. The snail, I should have changed that. That should be Ribeirurae eggs. But the Planorbid snail will come and ingest these eggs. And then within the Planorbid snail, it goes through another cycle where the free-swimming Caesarii will leave the snail, and they'll actually, see if I can show you, they'll actually swim up the bend of the tadpole and encyst. And inside the encyst forms another stage of the life cycle called the metacesarii. And this is what is known to cause, this encystment is what is known to cause all these malformations that you see within the frogs. Now, something else that cattle can do when they're in the wetland as an anthropogenic stressor is increase pathogen prevalence of feather.
Can you back up for a second?
Yeah.
Picture, sorry.
Yeah.
And you may have said this, but and I know that Liz hinted on it, so everybody can see this cycle, right? So the hypothesis is that the malformation by increasing the
I didn't finish the whole life cycle, but okay. So as I was saying, you could potentially have an increase in pathogen prevalence with cattle as well. And that, as I said before, and as Liz has mentioned, they can decrease water quality through the introduction of nitrogenous wastes, which could increase stress on a tadpole and result in an immunocompromised individual. Now, if you have pathogens within the water, such as rhinovirus or the chytrid fungus or Aeromonas hydrophila or even parasites, this immunocompromised individual could then be infected, and this could ultimately result in a mortality event. So this is just to give you an idea about amphibians and cattle in Tennessee, some quick facts, as you just have an idea of why we feel that this study is necessary. But most studies have occurred with cattle grazing itself, have occurred out west in large ranked lands and along streams out west. However, in Tennessee, 40% of the land area is farmland, and 50% of this land is actually used for cattle production. We have 48,000 cattle operations, according to NNAS and USDA in 2006, and we are ninth of the nation in beef cattle use, which I was surprised by. Also, the value of cattle in 2006 was $1.67 billion in Tennessee alone. Now, as far as amphibians are concerned, in the southeast, we have the highest richness. We have 44 anurans and 84 caudates. And according to Redmond and Scott in Tennessee, we have 21 anurans and 45 caudates. So about 50, we have a little over 50% of what's represented in the southeast. So to justify our study, Liz and I have already presented you with the fact that cattle can negatively affect emergent vegetation and water quality, and they can then negatively potentially affect resident amphibians. They also could potentially increase pathogen prevalence due to an increase of stress, making individuals more immunocompromised, and thus making them more susceptible to pathogens in the environment. Liz gave you some studies that she discussed with you, and these were studies that really quantified the effect that cattle had on amphibian adult abundance. And there have been no replicated studies for amphibians in general. And also, no studies have documented the effects of cattle in wetlands in the southeast or in Tennessee. So this is basically why we decided to take this particular study on. So here's the study area. It's the University of Tennessee Plateau Research and Education Center in Crossville, Tennessee. We have 8 wetlands, And four of these are access wetlands. They have had access to calcium for more than 10 years. And another four of these wetlands have never had access to cattle. Now, we did this study from the 28th of March to the 26th of August in 2005, and from the 27th of March to the 25th of August in 2006. The size range is about 0.153 to 0.129 hectares, and all ponds have fish. Fish have been introduced to every single one of the ponds, and I'll talk about fish composition a little later. Here are some images of the access wetlands. If you'll just note the water quality, some eutrophication is going on, soil compaction. And here's some images of our non-access wetlands. Now I'm going to go ahead and go into my methods. So my first objective was to determine the influence of cattle on larval amphibian abundance and richness. And I basically took each pond and divided it into four quadrants. And I used two techniques to sample for larvae. I used same plots was my first technique. And what I did was I set up a 10 by 3 meter plot, permanent plot, and then Liz and I would go out twice a week and we would walk for 7 meters with a seine net and then parallel to the shore. And then one person would stand permanent to the shore and a second person would kind of take the net and swing it in a quarter haul motion and then would lift the net up and count all the larvae and all the fish and all the aquatic invertebrates. Now for my second method, I used dip netting. What I did was I randomly generated azimuths through the center of the wetland, and each dip net transect was 4.5 meters in length. It had a dip site every 1.5 meters, and it had three sweeps at each dip net site. And I basically did the same thing. I counted all the larvae and the fish and the aquatic invertebrates that I captured. Oops. This thing is a little sensitive. Okay. For my larval sampling, when I caught the larvae, they were counted, identified them as species, and I identified all of the tadpoles as species except for toads. They were just identified to genus. They're known as the bufo in all my results. The first five larvae per species, the Gosner stage was recorded, which y'all talked about last week, I think. And then the body length and total length was measured, and they were each weighed. And as I said before, any fish and invertebrates caught were counted and identified. Now for water quality sampling, I sampled water every 2 weeks at a sample location, and it occurred at one cardinal azimuth. And this is just, again, my sampling schematic, so you can see that these are the cardinal directions, and so I basically did a rotation of the cardinal directions within a month. So I would sample at two cardinal directions within a month for every 2 weeks. And this sampling occurred 2.5 meters from shore, and the water variables that I measured were conductivity, specific conductivity, temperature, pH, and dissolved oxygen. I used a YSI probe to sample these. And to sample turbidity, I used a Lamont chlorometer, which is this thing right here. And for water collected from sampling location, I measured for ammonia, nitrite, nitrate, and phosphate, which I also used the Lamont chlorometer to measure these chemicals. Now for my third objective, to look at the influence of cattle on filamentous algae, biomass, detritus, and aquatic invertebrate abundance, I sampled once per month. And I measured this at two locations within my pond. Again, I randomly generated an azimuth, so I was sampling in two quadrants. And each sample was taken at a 0.5 meter depth, and I basically used a trash can, which I cut off the bottom, and all contents were collected using a dip net. And then the contents were collected and transported back to UT for sorting. So basically what I did in the lab, and as I sorted all the samples, all the algae and detritus were sorted out and separated and dried at 80 degrees C for 48 hours. They're weighed and the dry mass was recorded. And all invertebrates were sorted out and they're identified to family, except for aquatic worms and leeches, which were only identified to class. Now for the pathogen portion of my study, basically the pathogens were measured in the winter, summer, and fall of 2005. There were two species, bullfrog and green frogs, and the larvae were collected opportunistically, 5 individuals per species per wetland. We used dip netting and seining techniques for this. And each individual was transported back to UT where they were humanely euthanized using benzocaine hydrochloride. The body mass and length and developmental stage were measured for each individual. And then fixed and fresh tissues were sent to the University of Georgia Veterinary Diagnostic and Investigational Laboratory for further pathological testing. Now, I'm only going to present to you the FV3 results that we found that I don't know y'all might have heard before. I have documented different bacteria and parasites, but I'm still working with those results. So I'm going to tell you some of the identification techniques they used for FV3. They used virus isolation. This is all done in the Tipton lab. Electron microscopy, and that's actually right there is the FV3 particle that they found in one of the tadpoles, and then PCR. They also use PCR as a FV3 identification technique. You
probably can't hear me. Sorry about that, guys. Who was just listening? Okay, and now it's Liz's turn to talk about her methods. Yes. Yeah, that's the thought, is that some of them were placed there. And so we have records from the current manager there, and he's been there for, we have records for the last 10 years. So we don't really know what happened prior, but everybody's fairly certain that the land use has remained the same and that the access and non-access have remained the same for quite some time. But yeah, they're man-made wetlands. Yeah.
The thing is that our non-access ones are just in opportune locations for cattle grazing, and the access ones are opportune places.
Okay, so once we get out of the wetlands, what I sampled for, my first objective, was to determine the influence of cattle on species richness and relative abundance of the post-metamorphic amphibians. And I sampled for this in two ways, using pitfall traps and breeding call surveys. So pitfall traps, as Betsy described before, it's a silt fence. We used an erosion fence that I lined around half the circumference of each of the wetlands. And then 5-gallon buckets were placed every 5 or 10 meters on either side of the wetland. The difference in the bucket spacing is for an ancillary study. I'm looking at capture rates with different bucket spacings. But to give you a schematic, my schematic of the wetland, here you've got your wetland and you've got your pitfall traps and silt fence surrounding half the circumference and your traps on either side. All right. Around the fences that were placed at cattle access wetlands, we also erected an electric fence. And this was to prevent the cattle from trampling the silt fence and the buckets, as well as to prevent them from stepping in the buckets and injuring themselves. The pitfalls themselves were open twice per week, and we left them open for 24 hours and checked them and closed them. All the individuals that we caught were processed in this way. We first measured them snout to vent, so nose to rump, and we weighed them. And then I tagged them with a visible implant alphanumeric tag, which is this little thing here. Anybody who's done fish work has seen those before. And then I also gave each individual a unique toe clipping code. The reason why I did both of these marking techniques was for a second side study looking at effectiveness of different amphibian marking techniques. And so, okay, on to the second method for examining cattle influences on species richness. I used breeding call surveys. The surveys followed the North American Amphibian Monitoring Program protocol, which all of those of you who actually made it to the TAMP workshop should be very familiar with at this point. The only difference is that I used two survey durations, a 0 to 5 minute duration and a 0 to 10 minute duration. And this was for a third ancillary study looking at the difference in survey durations and their effectiveness at recording all the species at wetlands. So what Chandler and I did was stood at two permanent listening stations on opposing sides of each wetland, and we listened, and we did not share our survey results, and we assumed that we were both exposed to the same chorus. And following protocol, we began the surveys 30 minutes after the sunset. And upon arriving at each of the wetlands, we waited for a minute to let ourselves acclimate to our surroundings, as well as to let the amphibians there acclimate to our presence. And during each of the surveys, we recorded species occurrence and ranked their abundance. Abundance rankings followed the NAMP protocol as well. One was given when individuals could be distinguished and calls did not overlap. A two was given when individuals could be distinguished, but calls did overlap. And a three was given when we had a full chorus. The individuals could no longer be distinguished and calls did overlap. In order to fulfill objective two, which was to determine the influence of cattle on egg mass abundance, we performed egg mass surveys once per week. And we did so by visually surveying each wetland, by traversing a permanent belt transect in two randomly selected opposing quadrants. And each of these transects were 10 meters long and 2 meters from and parallel to shore. Again, here's our schematic. So here's my randomly selected opposing quadrants, and here are my egg survey transects. The other part of objective two was to determine the influence of cattle on shoreline vegetation structure and composition. So I measured vegetation structure and height using a graduated profile board, and then estimated percent horizontal cover in a 1 meter square plot, and also enumerated plant species in that 1 meter square plot. Did this once per month at the midpoint of the vegetative zone along another randomly selected azimuth in two opposing quadrants. Back to our schematic. So here's my randomly selected azimuth, and there's sampling spot at the midpoint of the vegetative zone. Okay, objective four was to determine the influence of cattle on pathogen and malformation prevalence in the post-metamorphic amphibians. So for my pathogens sampling, it was similar to Chandler's, except that I only had one sampling event, and that was in June 15, 2005. I caught five metamorphs of green frogs at each of the wetlands, simply because these species were the most abundant. My individuals were euthanized with the benzocaine hydrochloride and sent to Tifton Veterinary Diagnostic Lab for their comprehensive histological and parasitological analysis. And then at that point, they isolated and identified all bacteria, viruses, parasites, and any other pathogens that they encountered. To look at the malformation prevalence in the post-metamorphic amphibians, specifically looking for trematode prevalence, I collected opportunistically collected any malformed individuals that I came across. And I classified the malformations according to the USGS field guide, and then I euthanized them, fixed the individuals, and then cleared them. Now, clearing is basically putting the specimen through a series of dyes that stains that turns the tissue clear, but stains cartilage blue and bone red. And then this allows you to use a light microscopy to detect the presence of any encysted trematodes, which ideally come out as these perfect little obvious black dots. They don't do that in real life, but somehow in some studies they managed to get them to do that. Okay, for my stats, I pretty much used repeated measures ANOVA for almost everything, looking for relative daily abundance of amphibians was my response, used treatment and month for my effects. When there was an interaction, however, I needed to use two sample t-tests to separate the treatment and month effects. Again, repeated measures ANOVAs were used for egg mass, for mean total egg mass abundance. And I used that for all the vegetation variables, which were percent vertical and horizontal cover and height. And then I also used two sample Z-tests to compare my pathogen and malformation prevalence between treatments. Okay, Chandler found.
Yeah, I just had them just differently. All right, well, okay, so here are my results for larval abundance. I use repeated measures ANOVA as well for my analyses. I am presenting you actually just the five most common species that I captured. Along the y-axis, we have daily relative abundance of my captures. And then BUFO is basically, like I said before, Fowler's toads and American toad larvae. PCR is spring peeper larvae. Raca is bullfrog larvae, Rackle is green frog larvae, and Rapa is pickerel frog larvae. Blue is access or purple, and red is non-access. So as you can see, I caught a lot of bullfrogs, quite a bit. But in 2005, it was 2.9 times greater in non-access wetlands. In addition, Rackle were, in 2006, were 5 times greater in cattle in non-access wetlands as well. And all other species were not significantly different between treatment. So as far as larval diversity and richness is concerned, I have richness on your left, and then diversity is on your right. As you can see, there was a significant difference between access and non-access. Again, blue is cattle access and maroon is non-access. But in 2006, richness was 2.7 times greater in non-access wetlands. As far as diversity was concerned, there's no significant difference, although the trend was that it was 3 to 4 times greater between cattle access and non-access wetlands. Just to give you an idea of the species composition of what I captured in the two different treatments, orange represents my bufo species. Blue represents bull, red, green, and then this maroon is my pickerel, and this teal is my spring peeper. So basically, you have a large amount of bufos within my cattle access treatments, and then you have a large amount of ranids within my non-access treatments.
That's an important result, y'all. I write that down. And you'll see Liz's results later, which kind of echo that from the postmortem work standpoint. I'm sure we'll provide some explanations.
So this is just to give you an idea of what tadpoles look like from different species. These are my halids, cricket frog, spring peeper, and gray tree frog. And then my ranids, green tree frog, bullfrog, and southern leopard frog. And this one down here is a pickerel. And then I caught two different salamander larvae. I caught a mud puppy and also an eastern red-spotted newt. So just to give you an idea, I'm just going to basically tell you what I caught in these ponds as far as fish composition is concerned. There's more evenness, obviously, in the access wetlands. The red represents sunfish, green sunfish. The green is representing gold shiners. The yellow represents hatchling, basically just what I probably are, small baby sunfish, but I couldn't identify them to species exactly. Blue is bluegill. So you have a large amount of bluegill and non-access, and you kind of have more of an evenness in access. Here's some pictures of the species I caught. We did catch some largemouth bass, but those are mostly in non-access wetlands. But largemouth bass, bluegill, and green sunfish are all three known to be predators on amphibian larvae. Red-eared sunfish and gold shiner are non-predatory fish on amphibian larvae. So as far as water quality results, well, in 2006, I found that dissolved oxygen was 28.2% greater in non-access wetlands. And 2005 and 2006, specific conductivity was greater in access wetlands. It was 67.8% greater in 2005 and 70.4% greater in 2006. And for turbidity, it was significantly greater in access in 2005 and 2006 as well. It was 3.7 times greater in 2005 and 3.5 times greater in 2006. All other water quality variables were not significantly different, but ammonia, nitrite, and temperature were all higher in access wetlands. So algae and detritus. Algae is over here. As you can see, it's not significantly different between the treatments, but there's greater biomass in cattle access wetlands. Detritus was significantly different between treatments, and in 2005 it was 10.9 times greater in non-access wetlands. So for my invertebrate abundance, again, I just put the common species in here because I caught about 25 to 26 different types of taxa of invertebrates. But just to let you know what these are, this is a mayfly. Sierra are biting midges, chiros or non-biting midges, and they obviously made up a huge proportion of what I captured as aquatic invertebrates. Hero are my leeches. Less is a family of damselfly larvae. LIB is a dragonfly larvae. OLIG are aquatic worms. Fizz and plan are my two snails. And SFA is the little pea clam. So as you can see, there was a significant difference between treatments for dragonfly larvae. In fact, they are 1.8 times greater and 5.2 times greater in non-access wetlands. And then OLIG, my worms, were actually greater in access wetlands. Planorbids were greater in access wetlands as well. And what I just want you to note is that both of my species of snails were greater in access wetlands. And also, let's see here. The lest and the lib and the CN, which are known to be a little less tolerant to water quality issues, were more prominent in non-access wetlands. And all other p-values were not significant for all the other taxa. Again, just to give you an idea of what I captured, these three are less tolerant to water quality, bad water quality, and all of these are actually more tolerant to poor water quality. And these are the three that were greater in non-access wetlands. So just to give you an idea for my aggression model, I basically piled everything into a model from all my different variables. In 2005, I found that bufo species were positively associated with turbidity. They're actually negatively slightly associated with ammonia. Rapa, the pickerel frogs, were positively associated with other fish, and other fish is actually non-predatory fish. Bullfrogs were positively associated with other fish in 2006. And green frogs were negatively associated with specific conductivity and positively associated with species richness, which is basically Liz measured species richness, the difference in emergent vegetation, the species of emergent vegetation. And then in 2006, the pickerel frogs were positively associated with predatory fish. So to get into my pathogen prevalence results, Dr. Gray is actually working on publishing these results, so I'm sure he'll share these with you later. But if you'll just look at the FEV prevalence along the y-axis and along the x-axis are bullfrog and green frog larvae. Blue represents access and purple represents non-access. There was no significant difference between treatments for bullfrogs, but for green frogs there was a significant difference. In fact, green frogs were 3.9 times more likely to be infected with FEV3 in cattle access wetlands. We also looked at seasonal effects. Blue represents winter, purple represented summer, and white's representing fall. Again, FEV3 prevalence along the y-axis, along the x-axis, green and bullfrogs. Sorry, bull and green. So basically, bullfrogs were 7.7 times more likely to be infected with FEV3 in the winter than in the summer. And green frog tadpoles were 4.7 times more likely to be infected in the fall than in the summer. And there was no treatment by season interaction between these.
Is that stress related or what is that?
I'll get into that, but yes, it is immuno and stress related. So as far as developmental stage effect is concerned, with bullfrog larvae, there was actually definitely a trend and a significant difference. So there's a 28% decrease in predicted odds of infection with each unit increase in Gossner stage of development. And for green frogs, there was no developmental stage effect. There was no detectable trend. So summary of my results. Bullfrog and green frog abundance was greater in non-access. Species richness was greater in non-access wetlands. There was no significant difference in species diversity. As far as water quality is concerned, specific conductivity, turbidity were higher in cattle access wetlands and dissolved oxygen was lower in cattle access wetlands, and there was no significant difference in other water quality variables. As far as detritus and algae was concerned, detritus is greater in non-access wetlands, and there was no significant difference in algae biomass between treatments. Again, dragonfly larvae abundance was greater in non-access wetlands. Aquatic worm abundance was greater in cattle access wetlands. I actually should have planorbid up there, was greater in cattle access wetlands as well, should be up there. As far as my regression model is concerned, specific conductivity explained 82% of variation in green frog larval abundance, which is pretty amazing. And then for other fish, non-predators, explained 73% of variation in bullfrog larval abundance. FE3, green frog larvae were more likely to be infected with FE3 in Catalaxis wetlands, and FE3 prevalence was higher in cooler months for both species. And as development progressed, FE3 prevalence decreased in American bullfrog larvae. So now on to the discussion. So we documented that Catalaxis wetlands negatively impacted American bullfrog and green tadpole populations, and water quality and fish abundance were important predictors of abundance of these larvae. Green frog larvae are actually known to be quite sensitive to water quality issues, so this could be why this had an effect on their abundance. In addition, rainids are generally unpalatable for fish. However, they are very palatable to aquatic invertebrates. So if you have a higher abundance of fish, they're going to eat your aquatic invertebrates, and thus you could end up with potentially a positive relationship with the fish in the water. And it also appears that American and Fowler's toad tadpoles were not negatively impacted by Catalaxis. This could also be due to their high resistance to water quality. They are not negatively affected by high concentrations of ammonia in the water. Additionally, they are exploiting habitat where there's a lower abundance of rainids, and this could be due to the fact that they don't compete as well with bullfrogs and green frogs, and thus they want to exploit a habitat where they're not present. So for detritus and algae, we did find detritus greater in non-axis wetlands, and this could be due to an indirect effect from a lack of grazing pressure from cattle. Additionally, if you have more detritus, this is actually a better habitat for rainids because they like to burrow in the leaves. They use it as cover and they use it as a food resource. So that could help explain the abundance of rainids in my non-axis wetlands. Algae was a trend towards being greater in Catalaxis wetlands. This could be because of my trend towards higher nutrients. I had higher ammonia and nitrate and nitrite, even though these weren't significant results. As far as my invertebrates are concerned, my dragonfly larvae were found to be present more so in non-axis wetlands, and this could be because they are somewhat tolerant to pollution, and not what I'm trying to say is that they were found in both treatments. So, and that could be because they're somewhat tolerant to pollution as to why they were found in both treatments. But the reason they're found in greater abundance in non-axis wetlands could be potentially because they're not as tolerant to the water quality. As far as aquatic worms are concerned, it has been shown that they are very tolerant to water pollution, so that is probably why they were significantly greater in Catalaxis wetlands. So in general, there were more snails in Catalaxis wetlands. There was a slight change in composition for my invertebrates, but really it was just a difference in abundance before the taxa. And the more sensitive species were found in non-axis wetlands. I didn't present you all of my taxa results, but I had more caddisflies and mayflies, which are known to be sensitive species that I found only in non-axis wetlands. As far as water quality is concerned, we did note that cattle could negatively impact water quality. Reductions in water quality are known to increase mortality of amphibian eggs and larvae. Additionally, this can induce stress, making them more susceptible to pathogens within the environment. So for FE3, we have talked about water quality, the importance of water quality and what it can do to an individual. It could have affected green frog survival, which could have potentially compromised their immunity, allowing for pathogens to greatly infect them. As far as seasonal effects are concerned, lower temperature increases pathogen prevalence. Additionally, a low temperature causes a decrease in overall immune function, making you more susceptible to pathogens in the environment. Now, for the developmental stage, we had, for the bullfrog, there was a change. There was a decrease in FE3 prevalence as the bullfrog developed. And we have two hypotheses behind this, the first being that immunity could increase in bullfrogs over time, and the second being that tadpoles susceptible at earlier stages experienced mortality, and thus we captured a greater amount of tadpoles that were further along in development because of this. So those are my results and my discussion, and Liz is going to give you her results and discussion.
Harvest tadpoles over time, euthanize those individuals, and then do a variety of kind of immune function type screening to look at how their immune system is being affected.
Okay, so what did we catch out of the wetlands? Here are the inurine species that I caught. I'm sure you're all very well familiar with these at this point, but we've got our ranids, our green frogs, southern leopard frogs, our pickerel frogs, and our bullfrogs. We've got a few toads, fowlers and American toads, our spring peepers, gray tree frogs, and our northern cricket frogs. What you may not be as familiar with is the salamander species that we caught. So we caught mole salamanders, some Macaulay salamanders, eastern red-spotted newts, slimy salamanders, and mud salamanders. I'm presenting with this histogram just the results for the most common the most common species caught, which actually unfortunately didn't include any of the salamanders. We caught much more, many more anurans than we did salamanders. But here you can see the relative daily abundance of my most common, commonly caught amphibian species. That's on the y-axis. Our species are on the x-axis. This is American toads, fowler's toads, bullfrogs, green frogs, pickerel frogs, and southern leopard frogs. And the yellow bars represent non-access wetlands, abundance in non-access wetlands. Green represent, did I say that wrong? Yellow represent access wetlands, green represent non-access wetlands. Sorry. What you can note from this is that treatment effects seem to be species specific. Specifically, green frogs appear to be in higher abundance in non-access wetlands. In 2006, there actually abundance was 8.4 times greater in non-access wetlands. And trends were similar in 2005. They were 2.3 times greater in non-access wetlands in 2005. What you can also note that's interesting from this figure is that American toads and fowler's toads follow the same trend, seem to be more abundant in access wetlands. The significant difference that we see here is most likely actually due to lots of zeros in our data, so that's going to kind of skew the data. But nonetheless, the trend still exists of increased bufo species abundance in access wetlands. When we break down the green frog captures by age and sex class, we see that it's really green frog metamorphs that are driving these trends. The metamorphs were 9.8 times greater in non-access wetlands in 2006 and 2.5 times greater in non-access wetlands in 2005. Looking at species richness, it didn't differ between treatments, and neither did species diversity. However, species composition definitely shifted between treatments. This is very similar to what Chandler found. We've got the green are fowler's toads and the orange is American toads. So you can see that makes up 50% of the composition, roughly, of access wetlands. Whereas these are all your ranid species. We've got in the red, we've got southern leopard frogs. Purple, we have pickerel frogs. Blue, green frogs. And the yellow is bullfrogs. So that makes up just about the other half, and it's much more evenly split, whereas in your access wetlands, captures are totally dominated by the green frogs, and then the rest is pretty much made up of the rest of your ranid species. So that is interesting to note. Looking at my egg mass abundance, there was not a significant difference between the treatments. However, you can see this trend here of actually finding more egg masses in access wetlands and non-access wetlands. This is contrary to our hypothesis and may actually be due to visibility issues within the wetlands, because in due to our vegetation responses, we see that there was actually a significantly greater amount of vegetation in our non-access wetlands. In 2006, we found 84% higher vegetation and 74% greater in 2006 and 41% greater in 2005 for percent vertical structure of shoreline vegetation. Horizontal cover was 25% greater in 2006 in non-access wetlands at all. So this increased vegetation might have contributed to not being able to see those egg masses as well. That's a hypothesis. When we looked for pathogens, we did not find any differences in bacteria, viral, or parasitic prevalence in our green frog metamorphs between the treatments. But I did see 35 malformed individuals. That was out of roughly 1,900 individuals that I caught. So that gives you about a 2% malformation rate, which is normal for amphibians. It's been documented that in normal amphibian populations, malformation rates just due to genetics are between 1 and 5%. So this falls within that normal range. But nonetheless, I categorized each of these malformations into 11 different malformation types. And some of those included extra digits, got a foot growing out of a knee here, missing eyes, shortened limbs, split toes, or missing limbs altogether. When I looked at the prevalence between treatments of these malformations, there was no significant difference. 41% of the malformed individuals came from access wetlands, and 59% of them came from non-access wetlands. And I did manage to find two individuals that had trematodes in them, trematode metasercarii. However, one of those was found in an access wetland and one of those was found in a non-access wetland. So I don't get any significant differences there either. But it's interesting to see. So to sum up my results, green frog metamorphs seem to be negatively affected by cattle presence. And vegetation structure, horizontal cover, and height all are reduced in cattle access wetlands. Egg mass abundance did not differ between the treatments. And prevalence of pathogens and malformations did not differ between treatments either. The reduction in vegetation may have contributed to our seeing fewer abundance of some species in cattle access wetlands. As I mentioned in the introduction, these amphibians need vegetation as for sites for breeding, foraging, escape from predators, as well as egg deposition sites. And loss of this vegetation might be making some amphibian species move towards more vegetated wetlands. What's driving these trends, however, seem to be the green frog metamorphs. We may have seen these trends in the green frog specifically because we actually caught more green frogs than any other species. But it also could be that green frogs may be more sensitive to disturbance. As post-metamorphs, they may be heavily impacted by vegetative cover, and as larvae, they may be more heavily impacted by water quality, as Chandler mentioned. And toads, on the other hand, seem to be going in the complete opposite direction and being more abundant at the access wetlands, which is similar to the trends that Chandler found, actually identical. And this may be due to, as she mentioned, reduced competition. So there's fewer of the rannet species around, maybe because they move towards more vegetated areas. So therefore, the toad species are allowed to flourish with reduced competition for resources. They may also be out-competing species there. They may be better suited to areas with less vegetation. As we learned about in Betsy's talk, they have lower toad species lose water at a lower speed, so they might be less susceptible to desiccation. They also might be able to move better in areas with less vegetation. With shorter vegetation, toads can't hop as high or as far as rannet species, so they might be able to move better in these areas. And it may also be that toads can withstand lower water quality than other species. The study that Chandler mentioned by Joffrey and Karasov documented toads can tolerate higher concentrations of ammonia. So there we go in our water quality. And this follows Chandler's trends of finding higher ammonia, significantly higher turbidity, specific conductivity, DO, all in cattle access wetlands. And again, this might be reducing the immunocompetence of certain species, increasing their prevalence to certain pathogens such as FV3. And the survival of these tadpoles is going to affect what metamorphoses out of the wetland and hence what I can catch as post-metamorphs in a bucket. Now, when I looked at my regressions, I put all of these variables that I looked at, as well as many of the ones Chandler looked at, into regressions. They used all the vegetative variables, water quality, the cattle density at each of the wetlands, and the tadpole abundance. What I found was that for green frogs in 2006, specific conductivity was contributed to a lot of the variation in the model for green frog abundance. And the model fits fairly well, and specific conductivity actually explained 82% of the variation in that model. And that's a negative correlation. So as specific conductivity increases, meaning water quality decreases, we get a lower abundance of green frogs. Looking at toads, however, in 2005, we see that cattle density, nitrite, turbidity, and phosphate all contribute to that model, and that is an extremely well-fit model. Pretty excited about that. But 83% of that model for American toad abundance is explained by the cattle density, and that is a positive relationship. So as cattle density increased, so did the abundance of American toads. In 2006, it was also R squared of 0.99, so another well-fit model. 2006, turbidity, ammonia, and temperature seemed to explain the American toad abundance. And 90% of that model could be explained by, 90% of the variation in that model was explained by turbidity. That's what that actually says. So, and that's a positive association. So as turbidity is increasing, meaning water quality is decreasing, you're actually seeing an increase in American toad abundance. So what does all of this implicate? Well, what both of our studies combined seem to suggest is that cattle grazing may be contributing to the decline of certain species of amphibians. And we'd like to suggest that there be more separation of cattle and amphibians, but we obviously can't ask farmers to fence off their cattle from all of their wetlands. It's not going to happen. But what we can suggest is that they may provide alternative food and water sources for their cattle, or they could even fence off cattle from just a portion of their wetlands, something to do in order to try and at least reduce the impact of cattle on amphibian habitat may help improve or reduce the amount of amphibians that are declining. And so with that, we want to thank everybody who gave us money, which was our department, as well as TWRA. And we had lots of volunteers, so we'd like to thank them. Walt Hitch is the director of the Plateau Research and Education Center and is a wonderful guy, and all the staff members there were very helpful as well during this whole study. And that's our study. Anything we can clear up for you? That was our first time putting this together.
One interesting thing that I observed was it seemed that dragonfly larvae were more abundant in non-access wetlands, and it seemed like most of the predatory fish were higher. Dragonfly were statistically significant, mm-hmm. and then it seemed like at least the composition and maybe abundance was higher for a lot of predatory fish in the non-access wetlands, although not statistically significant. But nonetheless, more predators in the access wetlands, yet the non-access wetlands, in the non-access wetlands, yet it doesn't really seem to be having a negative impact on the amphibian communities. Unless you would look at bufos being negatively impacted, but that doesn't go along with the hypothesis that they're susceptible to predators, but generally they aren't because they have higher toxins as larvae and as metamorphs, etc., in adults in their skin. And so usually they're considered unpalatable species. So that's kind of an interesting thing because, you know, you look at a lot of the literature and predators have been shown, especially fish predators, well, and dragonfly larvae, as being main drivers of what you see in an urban community. So any thoughts about that, why it kind of seems to be different in your systems, or at least not a really important variable in your systems? Do these abiotic things that cattle are doing, as far as changing water quality and vegetation, those overpower predatory forces, you think, or what do you think?
Well, simply the presence of more vegetation in the non-access wetlands just might allow for them to hide.
So maybe even a healthier environment for the fish community. You just see more fish, it's a healthier environment, and you still have that protection there. So
if there's more of a diverse habitat there with more vegetation there, they might be able to hide. And there's been studies saying, you know, higher strata of the wetlands as well as out of the wetlands is going to increase your species richness as a whole, but it may also be providing for more habitat. It's a thought. We don't know the history of it, but it's definitely been stocked, and no one seemed to care or take note of what was being thrown in there. Just whatever was exciting to catch.
A lot of it was just haphazard. Just folks throwing stuff out there. I think there were a couple intentional releases. I think Dr. Wilson had a few hybrids that he released out there.
There's a few grass carp out there that were intentionally introduced to supposedly cut down,
cut down
algae.
We have some catfish we caught too, so.
Yeah, it's a few of those are nice little fishing holes for some people.
You know, one thing, I mean, y'all, just sitting back here and listening, you know, it's kind of interesting because you have several results that come out, you know, poor water quality, nail of the vegetation. And then, you know, you kind of have other things that don't seem to be negatively impacted by cattle or even maybe positively influenced. And so you definitely have these things going on that, you know, are affecting things and not affecting things. It's a pretty complex thing to tease out. What's your recommendation? Do you feel that cattle negatively are influencing at least some species? And certainly, there's evidence for green frogs, possibly some bullfrogs. Any feeling about the other less common species, or just, I mean, not being out there for 2 years, personal observations, anything?
It's kind of harder to see with our less common species because we're obviously not capturing them as much and we can't get a good feeling for them. Like southern leopard frogs larvae, I didn't even really start catching those until my second year. I didn't even catch them my first year. And that could just be method things, knowing your life history and knowing where you should really go to capture them.
But that was expressed in my metamorph captures. I caught tons more southern leopard frogs the second year. So, I mean, that kind of just shows the need for more long-term studies. Okay. 2 years isn't long enough.
Well, I mean, that is true. I think longer you live, better. I mean, your sampling, that was standardized. Like,
right.
Things were random, so
yeah.
It wasn't, like, necessarily.
Right.
And that's something going on in the community, whatever.
Right.
Is the reason why more southern leopards were showed up in that.
What I definitely noticed with a significant note that I could make out of was salamander abundance. Those wetlands that were next to forested areas had, those are the only places where salamanders really occurred. So there's that connectivity issue of just proximity of wetland to upland habitat. That seemed, although because we only caught literally a handful of salamanders, I couldn't show anything there. But your forested proximity to the wetlands probably makes a difference.
That was another was the detritus is through the roof and access non-access wetlands, and obviously the algae is through the roof and access wetlands. Any thoughts? I mean, the algae, yeah, that makes sense, right? You know, eutrophied type conditions. What about the detritus? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that could be directly correlated to the amount of shoreline vegetation. I mean, there's significantly more shoreline vegetation, you're going to get significantly more detritus, which might contribute to your increased stratification and potentially increased diversity of things in the water, fish and whatnot.
Oh, one other thing. Did you present your body size results, y'all?
Mm-mm.
Why don't you share those just real quickly, because that's
basically my larval, all my larval total length and body length was greater, and mass was greater in catalaxis wetlands.
I saw the same for all the post-metamorphic species.
We attribute that to be that there's possibly less abundance of larval amphibians in the water and less competition for resources, and then you can get larger more, you know, faster because you're able to eat more. That's one of the things we thought of.
And then you're bigger when you come out of the wetland too. Yeah, so just the lower larval density, I think we've mentioned studies about that, allowing you to get bigger before you even get out of the wetland, and then so you might be a better competitor once you get out of the wetland.
That was true for the toads too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's kind of
similar for everything.
We're seeing this trend of larger body size in the access wetlands. Of course, there's a lower density there. There's quite a bit of evidence that suggests that, you know, just from controlled studies and whatnot, that lower densities as far as a community result in larger tadpole body sizes, larger body sizes of metamorphosis. And so what is body size of metamorphosis is an important fitness parameter. It's related to greater probability of survival, greater probability of reproduction, greater fecundity, etc. So are less individuals but more fit individuals potentially, is that a bad thing or a good thing? And vice versa, is more individuals better than in being smaller better? And I just put that out there because I was asked the same question with the research out in Texas when we were at the meeting over in St. Louis. Because actually my results were different in the capacity that, but the trends are exactly the same with body size and density, is that out there, we were looking at agricultural wetlands were cultivated versus non-cultivated, so grassland wetlands versus ones that are completely surrounded by row crop agriculture, and I'll share with you some of these results, but basically individuals were smaller at the cultivated wetlands than at the grassland wetlands, but the densities were completely flipped around, so that we had greater densities of individuals at the cultivated wetlands and lower density of individuals at the grassland wetlands. So the relationship is identical in the context of density, increased density, decreased body size. But on the flip side of things, you all had lower densities at your anthropogenically disturbed wetland. I had higher densities.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a flip question to me. So is that a bad thing? Well, you've got more individuals. Yes, they're smaller, but the only way you would really be able to answer that question ultimately is following individuals over time and seeing how many are recruited into the population. And again, at least from the metamorph standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And even adults, These things are not just cut and dry. It's pretty interesting. There's a lot of complex relationships going on, and without a question, all this stuff is very species specific. And probably the greatest concern that, the trends that Liz and Chandler are finding are basically, they found it with those two ranids and they found it with bluegills. Well, that's what they caught. I mean, if you add up all those species, that's the total abundance. That's probably 80, 90% of your captures,
mm-hmm.
both sides. And so what's going on with these less common species, which are ultimately, those are the ones of concern. The ones that are low population, what's going on with the tree frogs going down in there? You're barely even capturing any. That's kind of that's part of conservation biology. It's hard to study or get enough data to make conclusions on rare individuals. And those are the ones that we generally have the greatest concern over. At least we have some trends that indicate that some are negatively positive, some are positively positive. And the whole bluegill thing, you see it time and time again in these anthropogenic studies. They seem to be like, bring it on. They seem to do fine for some reason. Some of it's probably related to their physical ability to withstand dry conditions, maybe poor water quality, and I think in some capacity, when you have a decrease in other species, I think they just like it. It gives them lot of those types of community ecology questions can only be teased out with controlled studies and mesocosm studies, those types of things. All right, questions, y'all?
Why would you expect green tree frogs down in a wetland like that?
Green tree frogs? Right. Well, I said tree frogs, but there aren't any green there.
Okay,
but gray tree frogs.
They would.
Well, all of our tree frogs are, well, I wouldn't necessarily expect them there because there aren't a whole lot of trees around.
Yeah.
Although y'all call it a gray tree frog.
Caught a gray tree frog.
Out in the pasture.
I found a few agmasses that were gray tree frogs.
Yeah, so.
So they're there.
Yeah,
they're definitely called a lot. We heard them a lot.
Yeah. So they fall out in these vegetated areas. And they do that anyway. Generally, they're canopy species when they're, for most of the terrestrial time, breeding time comes. If conveniently, evolutionary standpoint, they would call from trees or shrubs close to water, and then get down closer to water when they would actually breed. But they're all coming down to the wetlands to breed, ultimately, hopping up ground. Out there, they're going across pastures, stealing water.
And hanging out in little sheds.
there was
a shed next to one of our nastier wetlands. There's just a little concrete area, and there were consistently each year there was gray tree frogs that hung out in the top of it and right on top of the door. You'd be real careful when you closed it so you didn't smush them at the top. But yeah, they were making use of what was there for sure.
Yeah.